Welcome to Fanboy News Network, your guide to geek culture. I'm your host, Jeff Harris. And this is our first full episode since we really got into the full fall TV season. So I want to start out this time by talking about what I'm seeing on the geek-centric TV shows. Obviously, the big news is the comic book-based shows that are on the air right now. It seems like it's a flood. We talked about it before, about what was coming up, and now we've seen most of the debuts, so we have an idea what we're looking at. Of all of them, the most anticipated was The Flash, partially because it's a spin-off of the already successful Arrow, and it's the second attempt to do a Flash TV series. The big thing with The Flash, and we'll get more in depth next week on the written part of the site, because it'll be my next full review, but The Flash is a series that truly embraces its comic book origins. One of my major complaints in many past episodes and articles is that most of the DC properties seem almost ashamed of the fact they're based on comic books. The Flash is definitely bucking that trend. The Flash embraces its roots. Most of the characters are something based on the comics. They have yet to have a villain show up on the show who wasn't somebody from the comics, even if in a greatly altered form. So right there, you have huge acknowledgement of the source material. And it's just got a great cast. It works really well. And it doesn't hurt that it was CW's highest rated premiere in 5 years, and is consistently a winner in the ratings for them. So we're going to get a lot of Flash. And my hope is that the lesson is learned from this, that you can do a show based firmly in a comic book universe and have it be a success. Also, with Arrow, they seem to be definitely going in that direction. Ray Palmer was introduced this season. In the comics, he is the hero, the Atom. And every indication is that that's the route they're heading with him on the show. So bravo there. The other one that's making me really happy right now is Constantine. Now, the show does have some issues, but most of those seem to be around some of the other characters on the show besides Constantine. A lot of the, you know, characters that are just day players for that week's episode sometimes are a little underwritten. Really, though, that's a complaint of the first couple of episodes. By the third episode, when they started directly adapting material from the comics, it really took off. So I'm enjoying the show. There is some concerns that they just announced it's only going to get a truncated 13-episode season. This is leading fans to being terrified that we're not going to get a second season. I'm not as worried about that. This isn't the first time that NBC has done this. And frankly, NBC right now does seem to be very in favor of short seasons and yet continuing the shows, Hannibal being a great example. NBC is not afraid to follow the cable model. And even though Constantine is a late announcement that it's only going to get 13 episodes, I don't think it's doing that bad in the ratings. And NBC has said 13 episodes does not mean canceled. So we're going to hold out hope. And plus, I want to give it another couple episodes before I make a final verdict on it. But Matt Ryan as John Constantine, even though they pronounced the last name wrong, I've learned to live with it. But his performance otherwise, he is the character from the comics. This is completely 180 from the Keanu Reeves movie. So that's going great. The big issue is Gotham. And if you checked out the site in the last week or so, you'll see that I did write a full review of the first part of the season. And I will, of course, look at the whole season at the end. But for right now, it is a frustrating mix of really great material and really terrible material. And it drives me nuts because they do some wonderful stuff, particularly with anything involving the Penguin. And just, I want to take a moment. There was a recent review of the series on the website Bleeding Cool. All props to Bleeding Cool. It's one of the sites I normally read to keep up on geek news. But their review had a complete opposite. They loved Fish Mooney, Jada Pinkett Smith's character, and hated the Penguin. I can only assume this review came from the Bizarro universe, because the Penguin is the best part of the show. Everything really comes alive when he's on, and I just don't know what they're doing with Jada Pinkett Smith's character. Her clothes aren't even a crime against fashion. They're a full-on declaration of war. And after writing my review, I looked back at it and looked at everything that I said was great, middle of the road, and terrible. And I couldn't help noticing that everything that was terrible, the weakest parts of the show, revolved around the female characters. And it hit me that the writers are either underwriting the female characters or are just going in bizarre directions with them. But it's, if there's one place where the writing staff on Gotham have to improve, it's how they deal with their female characters. Now, since I wrote the review, they have had two major episodes focusing on Selina Kyle and her relationship with Bruce Wayne, given both of them are teenagers. But it's the first time we saw anything where real character development was going on, and the first time I was actually happy with something going on with one of the female characters. So there is hope. And the show does have great things going for it. It's got the Penguin. It's got Sean Pertwee as Alfred, which easily going to end up being, I think, one of my favorite portrayals of the character ever. It's got the first ever on-screen live-action portrayal of Harvey Bullock, and that goes great. So it's not that the show is completely hopeless. It's got a lot going against it, and none the worse than the fact that it's a prequel show. And prequel shows are always going to be problematic. You had an entire episode recently where the entire thrust of the episode was Selina Kyle and Bruce Wayne were in peril, being tracked down by assassins. By the very nature of the show, you know they're getting away okay. You cannot help but know how it's going to end, so you have to find drama elsewhere. I think they did okay because of how they're exploring stuff, but still, that's going to be an inherent weakness on a show like this. We still have the debut of iZombie, a Vertigo title, coming up mid-season. Honestly, there's not a lot of news one way or another on this. It's not getting any buzz, but it's also not getting any negative buzz. It's just sort of a show that is going to happen, and we don't know a lot about it. So we'll have to see where it comes there. The one thing I'm hoping is it is on CW, and considering their track record right now with Arrow and Flash, it leaves me cautiously optimistic. I have a suspicion, though, with all of the comic book shows really being successful this season, that we're going to see more next season. It just sort of stands to reason. I especially think DC is going to go to that well, just because it's going so well for them. But I do think there'll be some conflict with the film department. The Flash series is a huge success, but Warner Brothers just announced a Flash movie with a completely different actor. And I do think there's going to be some interesting attempts at reconciliation of the two. I sure hope the movie department doesn't trump the TV department and get the show shut down, which is something they have done in the past. So we'll have to wait and see. Really quick, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. This season is great. It really is. They're doing great work. I have not been disappointed at all. They don't have the hamstringing effect of having to hide Hydra like they did last season to not spoil Winter Soldier. The only problem I think S.H.I.E.L.D. is having is a lot of people abandoned it last season because of the odd ramp up to the Hydra storyline, and those people haven't come back and aren't realizing that the show is doing great work right now. So hopefully at some point it can overcome that, and it's still struggling in the ratings. I hope it does well, because as a piece of television and a tie-in to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it's great. And with that, I want to switch gears. And it's time to talk about an uncomfortable subject. And that subject is one I've covered many times, both here and in the articles. And that is, let's face it, harassment and misogyny in geek culture. And I have not yet spoken about Gamergate anywhere on Fanboy News Network. Now, I have been vocal about it in social media. I have talked about it in Tumblr and Twitter and made my position known. I do feel Gamergate is an organized harassment campaign, and I completely reject their assertions that they're even remotely interested in ethics and game journalism. If that were true, then they would have been going after Shadows Over Mordor and the big company's attempts to influence Metacritic reviews by courting the big reviewers. Instead, they tend to go after female indie game developers and anyone who speaks up about gender equality in games. So it's pretty damning. Obviously, that position is clear for me. I don't really feel the need to drive more on that because it really has been covered so much better elsewhere. But I just wanted to make sure, A, I made my position clear. I found it interesting. On Twitter, somebody recently posted, I assume, a rebuttal to something I wrote. It was some website called Celebrinado. And I didn't even bother responding to them because all they did was put a link to a very poorly written and badly thought out rebuttal of Anita Scorsese and her work. And all it's doing is reiterating several of the points from the Gamergate playbook. And it really, really didn't impress me on any level. I didn't respond to the person who wrote it because, well, let's be honest, somebody who writes something like that isn't going to be very receptive to a well-reasoned response. And Twitter is not the best place for a well-reasoned response. And this is really the thrust I want to talk about. The big problems we see right now is the structure of the social media. Now, you can get into a decent debate in Tumblr, but Tumblr's nature doesn't work well for back and forth. It's, the way it's blog posting and reblogging goes, it's not a place you really want to have a discussion. Twitter is not good for discussion because even though you can have a back and forth, you only have 140 characters, and that's not a really great place to get a good thought out. It also is a place that is very conducive to a lot of the silencing behavior that seems to be part and parcel of the strategies we see going on. There are some great sites that talk about the silencing tactics, the pile-ons, what is essentially Gish Gallops. If you don't know, Gish Gallop is where somebody dumps out a lot of false information quickly in a lot of different areas. And if you're debating somebody doing that, you have to spend all your time just refuting the nonsense that the first person wrote. And that's, it's a well-known tactic. And also just taking as fact false information. And then, of course, gaslighting. Trying to rewrite history and convince somebody that their perceptions of something is wrong. Twitter is great for performing all of these, even more so than Tumblr. The biggest problem is people get afraid of the harassment factor, of getting people coming down on them and, you know, the doxing concerns. And this isn't just limited to Gamergate. I've seen other people where a lot of harassment happens in these media. And the problem is that big social networks like Tumblr and Twitter, by their very nature, are very, very bad at dealing with these kind of concerns. And part of that comes from simply the amount of information coming through. So many people use them. And there is so much going on, and there is so much activity that the staffs for these services, the staffs for Twitter and Tumblr, cannot help but be woefully understaffed for trying to deal with them. This leads to the harassers having a feeling they can get away with it just by, you know, sheer volume, because there's no way that the social networks can really track down and get rid of all of the harassers. The worst they can do is suspend their accounts, and that's actually pretty useless because all they do is suspend the account. They don't do anything about blocking the violator's IP address. And the reason that's a problem is you suspend their account, all they have to do is go right back in, create a new one, and they can go right back to what they're doing. There's one incident going on, not related to Gamergate, interestingly, where there's one guy who is doing some systematic harassing of some women who are video makers online. They're minor internet celebrities, but he's got some weird sexual fetish thing going on with them, demanding they do some pretty bizarre behavior in videos for him. And if they don't comply, he's made death and rape threats. And he regularly gets his account suspended. Then he waits about a week. Then he comes back and starts over again because he can. Twitter does nothing to police him because they never built it in. And it's not something that they feel is worth their time and resources to pursue. So this presents a big problem. And honestly, a lot of people would be going, well, shouldn't they do something? The thing they're trying right now is they've worked with a third-party group to be the new resource for collecting harassment reports. This other group is sifting through them for the ones they feel are honest harassment issues and forwarding it to Twitter, but then Twitter still has to take those and do something about them. It's not the best solution, but at least it's a movement forward. But the real issue is, and I think this is what a lot of people forget, those of us that use these services, the users on Twitter and Tumblr and Facebook, we aren't their customers. We're their product. We're the people that provide content that bring other people to look at the site, where then the services can sell to advertisers so they can make money. So what those services are going to be interested in is keeping the flow of content going. So there's at times not the biggest incentive for them to actually go that deep in dealing with it as long as there's still the steady flow of content. So anything they work on is just to make sure that people keep using the service. And that's a horrible, horrible reality, but it's one we're going to have to deal with. And until something affects it on that level, these services aren't really going to be that inspired to change. Those are my thoughts regarding those issues. One last subject I want to touch on today, and there'll be an in-depth article on the overall series later, but wildcards. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar, wildcards is a shared universe by many authors, goes back to the 1980s. It was an attempt by a group of authors to create a shared superhero universe. The ringleaders of this particular group of authors are Melinda Snodgrass and George R.R. Martin. In fact, this is often looked at as the other series that George R.R. Martin does, and actually gets a bit of hate from the Game of Thrones fans because anytime new material comes out for Wildcards, Martin is the editor, and the Game of Thrones fans feel it takes his attention away from Game of Thrones, where they just want him writing more of those books. I've been a fan of Wildcards since the 80s. It's a superhero universe. It has its origins in role-playing because the original character ideas came from a role-playing game a bunch of the authors were playing. It has a superhero universe with a single origin for all superpowers, a virus brought to Earth by aliens. And it's always been an interesting series. It's the only other series really like this I can think of is Thieves' World. And Wildcards was set up differently in that Thieves' World, you ended up with a lot of one-upmanship between the authors and messing with each other's characters. And Wildcards was set up so that the creators of the characters had far more control over their fate. They couldn't just be screwed over by another author. That author would have to ask permission to use them of the character's creator. And it's always been a great series. It's an alternate universe because it does deal with how the presence of superpowers would affect world events. So it's always been a great series, and the latest book came out, entitled Lowball. All Wildcard books tend to have poker themes somewhere in their names. Good novel. It's the second book in the latest series. They always kind of break Wildcards down into sub-series or trilogies where several books will cover a theme, and the latest series has been involving a police precinct that deals with a lot of the characters with superpowers in the Wildcard universe. Point is, latest book came out, and I'm not going to get in depth on the storyline because there's way too much going on for the time remaining in this podcast, and I'll cover more when I write the review of the series. The thing with the latest book that drove me crazy, though, I was really enjoying it. There were some good parts, there were some weak parts. Anytime you're having a book that has multiple authors, it's basically a collection of short stories all falling around a central theme and interrelating, different parts of those stories are broken up into sections, so there's a linear progression. They always called them mosaic novels. Anyway, the thing that drove me crazy about this particular novel is clearly at the end, it's meant to end on a cliffhanger. And so the plot is not fully resolved at the end. It's clearly leading up to something. My problem is, usually on a cliffhanger, there has to be at least some resolution so that you feel like, okay, I've finished this story, but I can't wait to see what happens to this character in the next. This one, it literally feels to me, the way they ended it, like you're partway through the story, action is happening, and then the book just stops. It doesn't feel like a cliffhanger so much as, and then it just stops. It is honestly one of the worst endings for a book I've dealt with in a long time. And so despite the fact that I liked it, and I will in all likelihood get the next novel because A, I want to see what happens next in the story, and I am a huge fan of the series, but that was one of the worst endings. This honestly is something I'm going to get a chance to meet George R. R. Martin this spring because he's going to be a guest at NorwestCon, our local science fiction convention. And I think I'm going to ask about this because it really, I mean, it was jarring how it ended. So if you're a fan of the Wildcard series, it's worth reading because it is continuing the story and it is continuing the plot threads that were introduced in the previous book, Fort Freak. But from a structure standpoint, it had just one of the most bizarre endings ever. And I've read Wildcard novels forever, and they have ended on cliffhangers before, but this literally, the last line should have been the indication of to move on to something else, and it just ended. Also, without giving too many spoilers for the book away or what I'm about to reference, there's an implication at the end that the entire plot of the book on some level was a ripoff of the movie Cabin in the Woods. It was all very strange. Anyway, that's it for that, and I think that's it for this week. So thank you very much for listening. If you want to get in touch with me, I can be reached at Caliban@fanboynewsnetwork.com. I am on Twitter as Caliban1227, and I have a Tumblr, of course, fanboy-news-network. With that, thank you very much for listening, and you all take care. We'll talk later. This program is produced by Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network and is copyright 2014 to Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network. All rights are reserved, including rights to copy and redistribute this program. All music in this podcast comes from The Footage Firm and is used under a royalty-free license.